If you look at the stats, My Fair Lady is arguably the perfect musical.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, it broke every box office record. It practically defined the golden age of Broadway. And the cast album sat at number one on the charts for 15 weeks.
It just feels so inevitable when you look back at it.
Right. But when you actually dig into the production history, which is what we're doing today for this deep dive, you realize this show is a minor miracle.
Yeah, it wasn't just difficult to write. It was technically considered impossible.
Exactly. And we're going to get into all of that. We've got the original Wikipedia archives on the cast and the reception. We're looking at the production history and specifically the creative battles between the writers and the estate of George Bernard Shaw.
And that's really the mission here. We want to explore how a play about phonetics and class structure, with no love story, by the way, became this massive global phenomenon.
Which is crazy because the biggest names in the industry looked at the source material and basically said, you know, this cannot be done.
They really did. And to understand why, you have to look at that source material. George Bernard Shaw's play, Pygmalion.
Shaw was notoriously protective of his work.
Very. He had explicitly refused to let anyone turn Pygmalion into a musical.
Because he had been burned before.
Exactly. There was an operetta called The Chocolate Soldier, which was based on his play, Arms and the Man. And Shaw absolutely loathed it.
He hated it.
He felt they stripped out all his social commentary and just replaced it with romantic fluff. So from then on, he had a strict rule, no musicals.
But Shaw died in 1950.
Right. And that's when the floodgates opened for Pygmalion.
But the wild thing is, it wasn't Alan J. Lerner and Frederick Lowe who tried it first. It was Rodgers and Hammerstein.
The absolute titans of Broadway.
Literally the guys who invented the modern musical. And they gave up.
They tried and they completely abandoned it.
They told Alan J. Lerner it was impossible because it violated all the key rules of musical theater at the time.
There was no main love story. There was no secondary love story or subplot. And there was just no logical place to put a singing ensemble.
It's all just cerebral drawing room arguments. You can't just pause an argument for a nice romantic ballad.
The tension just dies.
Yeah.
So Rodgers and Hammerstein said pass. And honestly, Lerner and Lowe actually listened to them?
They did. They completely abandoned the project for 2 years after hearing that.
It took a total fluke for them to come back to it.
Oh, right. The obituary.
Yeah. So Gabriel Pascal, the film producer who controlled the rights to Shaw's plays, he died. And Lerner happens to read his obituary.
And that just sparks something.
Exactly. He starts thinking about Pygmalion again, trying to figure out if there was a structural loophole they missed.
And the loophole they found is brilliant. They realized they didn't need to change the play's structure or cram songs into the dialogue.
They just needed to expand the timeline.
They added the action that took place between the acts of the play.
Right, because in Shaw's play, weeks or months might pass between scenes. So Lerner and Lowe decided to actually show what happens in those gaps.
The vocal training, the struggles.
The moments where Eliza is actually learning. It opened up the whole world of the show.
But even with that creative breakthrough, they still had a massive problem. The rights.
Oh, the rights were a nightmare. Because Pascal had died, his estate was controlled by Chase Manhattan Bank.
A bank managing theatrical rights.
Yeah, and MGM was aggressively fighting for those rights, too. So Lerner and Lowe are sitting there, and Frederick Lowe comes up with this incredibly bold strategy.
It's my favorite part of the story.
He tells Lerner, "We will write the show without the rights."
Just completely rogue.
Totally rogue. His bet was that the bank was going to take months to figure out the legal mess. And by the time they did, Lerner and Lowe would have a finished script and score.
While MGM would just have a pitch.
Exactly. They bet that their work would be so undeniably good that the bank would have to give it to them.
And it worked. They spent 5 months writing it on spec, basically.
It's an insane gamble, but the bank handed them the rights.
So they have the rights. They have the script. Now they have to cast it. And we have to talk about finding Henry Higgins.
Noel Coward.
Right. Noel Coward was their first choice.
Which makes sense. He had that sharp, witty, upper-class persona, but he turned it down.
And he's the one who suggested Rex Harrison.
He specifically told them, you have to get Rex for this.
Meanwhile, they're trying to find their Eliza Doolittle. They asked Mary Martin. She declined.
And then they discovered Julie Andrews.
She was doing her Broadway debut in The Boyfriend.
Just this young, fresh talent.
Well, back to Rex Harrison. He says yes, but he is completely terrified.
He was a serious straight play actor. He had never sung with a live orchestra before.
He called them the 32 interlopers in the pit.
He was so intimidated by the musicians, and this fear built up so much that it led to a complete meltdown on the day of their first preview in New Haven.
Oh, the dressing room incident.
Yeah. There was a blizzard outside, terrible weather, and Harrison just snaps. He locks himself in his dressing room and outright refuses to come out.
He's just shouting through the door that he can't do it.
And the producers panicked. They actually dismissed the company.
Wait, they sent the cast home?
They told the cast and the orchestra, it's over, go home.
Wow.
But then, about an hour before curtain, Harrison suddenly unlocks the door and says, okay, I'll do it.
So they had to scramble to recall everyone who was already halfway down the street in a blizzard.
Absolute chaos. But the curtain goes up, and the opening was a massive success.
Which brings us to the actual story on stage and the huge controversy surrounding it.
Right, because for anyone who doesn't know, the basic plot is about Eliza Doolittle, a Cockney flower girl, and Henry Higgins, an arrogant phonetician.
Higgins makes a bet with Colonel Pickering that he can teach Eliza to speak so perfectly that he can pass her off as a lady in 6 months.
And the musical tracks this with these iconic moments, the rain in Spain, which is their big breakthrough.
I could have danced all night.
The Ascot racecourse scene, where she hilariously slips back into Cockney slang during the Ascot gavotte.
But it all builds to the ending. And this is where the Shaw purists lost their minds.
Yes. Shaw's original play was fundamentally not a romance. He loathed the idea of Higgins and Eliza ending up together.
In his version, she realizes her worth and she leaves him. Period.
But the musical draws from the 1938 film Ending instead. In the stage show, Eliza comes back to Higgins. He's sitting there and he just tilts his hat down and asks, "Where the devil are my slippers?"
And it plays as this great romantic triumph. The audience swoons.
But the critics who loved Shaw the Shavians were furious.
Eric Bentley, the critic, had some harsh words for it.
He called it a terrible treatment of Shaw's play. He admitted it was a delightful show, but he argued that it completely undermined Shaw's basic idea.
It's that tension between Shaw's feminist manifesto and Broadway's need for a romantic gloss.
Exactly. You're taking a story about a woman claiming her independence and ending it with her seemingly returning to serve a man who verbally abused her for months.
It's a heavy shift. But obviously, audiences didn't mind because the show became an international sensation. Which leads to this incredible moment in Berlin.
1961.
October 1st, 1961. The Theater des Westongs in Berlin.
The context here is just wild. The Berlin Wall had literally just been erected weeks before this. The border was closed.
So the city is completely fractured. And this is the very first Broadway musical to be staged in Berlin since before World War II.
But because of the wall, East Berliners couldn't attend anymore. Half the audience was cut off.
So what did they do?
They set up what was called the Musical Air Bridge. They literally chartered flights to bring theatergoers from West Germany into West Berlin just to see My Fair Lady.
Just to keep the theater full.
To keep it full and to make a statement. It became this massive symbol of West Berlin's cultural renaissance, a symbol of resistance against the isolation of the wall.
It is so strange to think of Higgins and Eliza as Cold War symbols, but there it is.
It really was.
So the stage show is changing history in Europe. But back in Hollywood, the 1964 film adaptation is making a different kind of history.
Drama, pure drama.
Jack L. Warner at Warner Bros. Buys the film rights, and he makes a casting decision that people still argue about today.
He refuses to cast Julie Andrews.
Even though she originated the role, she won all the acclaim, she was Eliza.
Warner's argument was that she lacked name recognition. She had no film experience, and this was a massively expensive movie. He wanted a guaranteed box office draw.
So he casts Audrey Hepburn.
Who is a legend, obviously. But the irony is just almost painful.
Because Audrey Hepburn wasn't really a singer.
No, her singing was heavily dubbed by Marnie Nixon.
Right. And meanwhile, Julie Andrews, having been rejected for My Fair Lady, is suddenly free to go make a little movie for Walt Disney called Mary Poppins.
Which came out the exact same year.
And what happens at the Oscars?
Julie Andrews wins Best Actress for Mary Poppins.
And Audrey Hepburn wasn't even nominated for My Fair Lady.
It's the ultimate Hollywood poetic justice.
But it wasn't just the casting that upset people. Alan J. Lerner himself deeply disliked the film adaptation.
He really did. He felt it didn't live up to the original stage direction by Moss Hart.
He hated that Warner shot the whole thing on sound stages in Burbank instead of on location in London.
He felt it looked synthetic.
Despite all that, the film is gorgeous, and it won Best Picture. It really cemented the show's legacy.
Oh, totally. I mean, The stage show originally opened to unanimous raves. The New York Times called it one of the best musicals of the century.
It was the longest running show on Broadway at the time. 2,717 performances.
And it's never really left the cultural consciousness. Look at the revivals.
Yeah, 1976, 1981, 1993 with Richard Chamberlain.
Jonathan Pryce did it in London in 2001. And there was that 2007 concert with Kelsey Grammer as Higgins.
It just keeps coming back.
Yeah.
And I think part of the reason it endures is the complexity of that central relationship. There's a piece of trivia about the original poster artwork that I think captures it perfectly.
The Hirschfeld illustration.
Yes. If you look at the original poster, it features George Bernard Shaw up in the clouds.
Like a heavenly puppet master.
Exactly. He's pulling strings on Henry Higgins down below.
And then Higgins is holding his own strings, trying to control Eliza.
It's this brilliant visual metaphor for the entire history of the show. Shaw trying to control his legacy, the creators wrestling with the characters, Higgins trying to mold Eliza.
Everyone is trying to pull someone else's strings.
Which brings us back to that ending, the impossible adaptation that became a Golden Age masterpiece.
It's a masterpiece, but it leaves you with a really tough question.
Right. I want to leave you, the listener, with this to mull over. Hmm? We know Shaw hated the romantic implication. We know the musical ends with Higgins demanding his slippers.
Yeah.
So given all of that, when Eliza stays, does My Fair Lady actually celebrate her independence and transformation?
Or does it ultimately just reinforce the very class and gender dynamics that Shaw was trying to critique in the first place?
Is the perfect musical actually a tragedy in disguise?
I guess it depends on how you look at the slippers.
Something to chew on. Thanks for joining us. See you in the next deep dive.